Good evening, dear friends, dear Tiger Mountain Sangha and Peaceful Refuge Sangha, and anybody else who shows up, everyone is welcome. It's really lovely to be here together again for our fourth talk of the year. Let's take a few conscious breaths and just settle our bodies in this place and time. And take a moment and look around at all the friends who are here together. Just being here together, just seeing each other's faces, it's a wonder, a miracle. So here we are, doing our best to show up for life, appreciating and using all the gifts that we've been given. So tonight, our theme is called Heart-Centered, the Path of the Spiritual Warrior. And I did kind of maybe an overly cute thing with the titles of the talks this year. If you remember, we started our year with Welcome Everything. And then the second talk, the name of it became Everything Matters. So then it seemed like, well, then I needed to continue using the word that I had used before. So the third talk was called Matters of the Heart. And so the fourth talk is now called Heart-Centered. So that's been our flow, kind of one of the flows going on through this year of practice. And we're going to do something a little bit different tonight in our scheduling. We're going to start out with about a 10-minute meditation, and then we're going to have part of a talk, and then there'll be two guided meditations during the talk. So it's kind of a flow. And we know that listening to the Dharma is a meditation. So we're all just in our meditation flow from now on. And we're starting out with a poem by Larry Ward. And I think most of us, if not all of us, know who Larry Ward is and was, our good friend and teacher, who died a few months ago. And he was a poet. And the last part of his life, the last few years of his life, he really focused on his poetry. And he didn't have very many things on his bucket list before he died, but having his book of poetry published was one of the things. And it got published shortly after he died. And his wife Peggy is now on a virtual online book tour with the book. And just today, this morning, there was an event with Tricycle Magazine that she was part of. And so the book is called Morning Night, and it's a wonderful book of poetry. And I've asked Tim to read a poem of Larry's and then lead us in silence for about 10 minutes. And then we'll finish up. So take it away, Tim.
Thank you, Barbara. Hello, everyone. So happy to see you. Let's settle into our space. Let's be aware it's right now. And we're right here. Feeling whatever contact points you have with Mother Earth. Feeling your breath go through the tip of your nose, cooling as it goes in, and then coming out and warming. Your Precious Humanity by Larry Ward. I say that each of us are called to shake the temples of heaven and earth as we reconstruct the sanctuary of our hearts and minds. Fill this sanctuary, however small, however mundane, with the thunder of fierce equanimity, with the wind of compassion, with the fragrance of justice, with the elegance of joy, with the grace of bravery, and the sweetness of love. Remember, no birth and no death hide in all phenomena, including all things that come into the experience of your body and mind. Be not afraid, flee not, despair not. Fall deeper into the depths of awakening of your precious humanity as you stand up in the house of belonging. Be not afraid. Flee not. Despair not. Fall deeper into the depths of awakening of your gracious humanity as you stand up in the house of belonging.
Thank you, Tim and Jan. Take a moment to stretch. Hydrate if you'd like to. Shake if you feel like it. Sigh if you feel like it. So tonight, dear friends, our theme is stepping into our potential to become a spiritual warrior. Some of us may have a reaction to the concept of warrior, but as spiritual warriors, we're not fighting against anything. We're not fighting at all. What we're doing is mobilizing, calling up all our energy and life force in the service of love, healing, and connection. A spiritual warrior lives a life of integrity. A spiritual warrior lets nothing get in the way of loving. As we look around us and feel the shaking of the roots of the world we used to know, it becomes obvious that we have no energy to waste, no time to pretend we aren't the powerful beings we truly are. We need to let go of limited beliefs and embody our highest selves. So how do we do this? A spiritual warrior is the living embodiment of our mindfulness trainings. We make choices based on love, kindness, openness, and inclusiveness. Most important, we don't spend 1 minute believing in separation, but live in the reality of interbeing. And all our thoughts, words, and actions come from this insight. Now, this is a challenge because we live in a world of duality. It's our physical nature. To believe we're separate comes naturally to us, and our perceptions reinforce this belief. It may well be that this dance of illusion is a necessary part of our evolution as a species, that we each need to develop our unique abilities, talents, and skills, and offer them to the whole as we move forward. But at the same time, we cannot be fooled into thinking this is the whole of life. This is just our dance of the day, and behind it is the thundering reality that all our magnificent pieces and parts are woven into one brilliant fabric. In the face of the raging polarity in our world, escalating into extreme violence, it's so hard to know what to do. We can be easily overwhelmed with hopelessness. The spiritual warrior needs, first of all, to guard against feeling like a victim. There is always something we can do, starting with our own bodies, our own minds and hearts. Our thoughts, words, and actions have consequences, even if the audience appears to be only ourselves. From our essence, we send out energy, either of fear or of love. We need to be vigilant in choosing love. We know our world is in desperate need of it. Several months ago, I noticed that when I found myself with others who started referring to a group of people as other, I felt a constriction in my heart and a clenching in my belly. I realized that my body was reminding me that it isn't helpful to reinforce seeing the world that way. So I would gently remove myself from engaging in the conversation. I became curious about this pattern and eventually realized that instead of seeing this way, which has the flavor of victimhood, I could turn it around. Now I realize that if I cannot understand why another group of people believes what they do, I take that as a signal that my world is too small. I need to engage my open-hearted curiosity to understand better. Usually, when I shift into this kind of openness, resources show up that help me begin to connect, and my understanding grows. If your intention is to see with the clarity of Manjushri, an insight that helps you acknowledge how your view is limited is a wonderful gift. This is the first noble truth. Seeing and acknowledging suffering that is inherent in our limited view of reality. Sometimes it takes strong messages of confrontation to wake up, and waking up is always good, but not always easy. So to accept our world as it is now, to do our best to stay open and present, is our first step. Chogyam Trungpa Rinpoche said, "If you open to the world as it is, the best human qualities will emerge." It becomes so clear how much we need a Sangha, a community, to do this together. We need the strength, solidity, and clear seeing of our brothers and sisters in the Dharma for support when our confidence wavers. And when we feel strong and grounded, our support is greatly needed by the community. I'd like to spend a few minutes exploring the teaching on the three doors of liberation, and then speak more about the art of becoming a spiritual warrior. The three doors of liberation is a foundational teaching and is described in Thay's book, The Heart of the Buddha's Teaching. The three doors, or the three pathways to liberation, are emptiness, signlessness, and aimlessness. They're also called the three concentrations. They point us toward ways of being right now that can help us navigate these times and show us how we can be of help. The first is emptiness, or interbeing. And we know this teaching well by now. We know that our work is to penetrate the illusion of separation and experience the collective reality of love that is our foundation. To do this, sometimes we need to learn to take a deeper and broader view. Instead of being tossed about by the events of last week's chaos, we need to anchor our worldview in the past 100,000 years of the evolution of our species. The British philosopher Tim Freake posits that the revolution of you as an individual is just what the universe needs to move forward. You, developing your individuality, is the foundation for stepping into becoming what he calls a univisual. Freak explains that while the cells in slime mold all do the same thing, the cells in a human all do different things. In the same way, each individual contributes their own unique capabilities to the greater whole. So develop your personal skills, talents, and abilities, and offer them to the whole. This will strengthen our community and contribute to our spiritual evolution. The quantum physicist John Wheeler describes our universe as participatory. He says that our universe consists of huge clouds of uncertainty, because at the quantum level, there are all these potentialities that haven't come into relationship with anything yet. We are living in relationship, but also in potential. I think it's important to note that the uncertainty also means potential. We need to remember that we can't see it all from here. We need to lean on our ancestors, on the teachings, and on our collective experience to keep us grounded and confident as the winds of change sweep around us. As we hike up a mountain, we need to pay careful attention to each step on the path, and at the same time to hold in our hearts the aspiration for a greater view, so we can become beings of great equanimity, of clear seeing, and of unconditional love. This is the evolutionary course we are on. If our species is to evolve instead of destruct, it's required that we learn to see and live this way. The second door of liberation is signlessness. This teaching refers to how we translate and make meaning of our perceptual experience. A sign is a conventional designation, the name we assign to each object and experience. These designations are very useful. They keep our perceptual world from being a chaotic jumble of experience, but they also mislead us, as we tend to get lost in believing that they're the whole of reality. We know that these assignments are arbitrary and conditioned. There's no inherent reason one thing is called a table and another a banana. But we often forget this and start believing this is reality. We develop stories about these designations and then start to believe that the stories are inherently real. And then we might grow to believe we have to defend the story around the designation. Suddenly, we are at war with some other person or group who question or oppose our conventional symbolic designations. The Buddha wisely instructs us to please remember that these perceptual experiences represent only the thinnest layer of reality. That shining beneath and all around what we see is a deeper truth. We need to learn to not believe so much in the surface appearance of things, such as the daily news. With signlessness, we learn to not trust our perceptions as reality. The psychotherapist Francis Weller reminds us that though we often see our world as binary, such as good and bad, light and dark, etc., the reality is that these qualities are complementary. They're inextricably linked. Tai often reminded us of this when he would hold up a stick and point to the left and the right, and remind us that there's no way to remove either the left or the right. If you try to cut off the right side of the stick, you've made the stick shorter, but there's still a right side. No matter how short the stick becomes, there's always a right and a left side. This is the nature of our world. We need darkness. We need to know that space of quiet and silence. Darkness invites imagination. It invites gestation, incubation, and a pause. Weller tells of a wonderful Inuit word, kortsaluni, which means sitting quietly together in the darkness waiting expectantly for something creative to burst forth. This came from the practice of the whalers, who wouldn't go out to hunt until the whales gifted them with a song. They had to wait for this relational intimacy between species to be fulfilled, so that the covenant was honored. They do this out of reverence and out of restraint. Weller offers this as a timely metaphor for where we are right now. He says, we have to sit quietly together in the darkness and wait expectantly to see. Restraint is not an American value, but it's one we're having to learn. We can't just keep extracting from this earth and from people. We have to learn humility, reverence, and restraint. Not knowing is part of the humility. We're not going to think our way through the long dark. The thinking has gotten us into the problem in the first place. Thinking isn't bad, but what we're hearing in this not knowing is that we have to become receptive to a larger dream. We need to carry the awareness that while our perceptions connect us directly to this moment, they can mislead us if we don't hold our hearts in our hearts the bigger story, the one that's fueled by the ultimate dimension, our bodhicitta, our bedrock of love and connection. And our third door of liberation is aimlessness, which again is about perception. When we have an idea in our mind of what we want or need, our view narrows and cuts out other possibilities which we may not have considered or even conceived of. When we relax and open our view to new possibilities, our lives can become richer, more creative, and filled with magic. Hermann Hesse, in his novel Siddhartha, said, when someone is seeking, it happens quite easily that he only sees the thing that he is seeking, that he is unable to find anything, unable to absorb anything, because he is only thinking of the thing he is seeking, because he has a goal, because he is obsessed with his goal. Seeking means to have a goal, but finding means to be free, to be receptive, to have no goal. For in striving towards your goal, you do not see many things that are under your nose. We sincerely want to know how to help, to fix things in order to lessen the suffering. But sometimes we just have to rest in the dark. The poet John Keats talked about negative capability, which he defined as, quote, when man is capable of being in uncertainties, mysteries, doubts, without any irritable reaching after fact and reason. In her book, Strong Ground, Brené Brown says, negative capability is a difficult muscle to build. We're wired to resolve tension and seek certainty. This capability requires the courage to reach inward toward stillness, rather than out toward counterfeit facts and reason. Negative capability is a grounding tool, and it is fundamental to practicing courage. The ability to rest in doubt and continue to pay attention in order to understand more completely. Looking at matters from multiple perspectives. These are skills fundamental to our practice. We are more likely to gain new insights if we can stop assuming that we know everything we need to know about people by neatly shoehorning them into preconceived boxes. Aimlessness to me is about learning to trust. All this uncertainty and chaotic change creates a great opportunity to give up trying to control, or even to understand what's going on and what the path is, except for just the next step. Sometimes, not even the next step. Just trusting that as you begin to place your foot, the ground will be there because you can't even see one step ahead of you. Some of you might remember the story of when Thay went to lead walking meditation in the downtown streets of Seoul, South Korea. I believe over 5,000 people showed up, and Thay was flooded with so many people around him. He stood there, and he couldn't even see the ground in front of him or where to place his foot. At that moment, he realized that he couldn't do it. He couldn't even take the first step. So he told the Buddha, "You will have to do this for me." That insight led to Thay's famous teaching about how to let the Buddha breathe, let the Buddha walk. The insight that there is no breather, no walker, separate from the action of breathing and walking. Organizational psychologist Adam Grant says that what's most needed now is not more thinking, but what he calls rethinking, the ability to assess our thoughts, beliefs, and assumptions. He says, quote, "Most of us take pride in our knowledge and expertise and in staying true to our beliefs and opinions. That makes sense in a stable world where we get rewarded for having conviction in our ideas. The problem is that we are living in a rapidly changing world where we need to spend as much time rethinking as we do thinking." He continues, "With advances in access to information and technology, knowledge isn't just increasing, it's increasing at an increasing rate. The accelerating pace of change means that we need to question our beliefs more readily than ever before. This is not an easy task. As we sit with our beliefs, they tend to become more extreme and more entrenched. When it comes to our own knowledge and opinions, we often favor feeling right over being right." He also reports that studies show that smart people believe they're more objective than others. The brighter you are, the harder it is to see your own limitations. Being good at thinking can make you worse at rethinking. Grant sums up what is needed now in this way. He says the process of rethinking unfolds in a cycle, starting with intellectual humility, knowing what we don't know. Recognizing our shortcomings opens the door to doubt. As we question our current understanding, we become curious about what information we're missing. That search leads us to new discoveries, which in turn maintain our humility by reinforcing how much we still have to learn. If knowledge is power, knowing what we don't know is wisdom. I never know where I'm going to receive insight, like a tiny new way of seeing what's going on that helps me open to possibility. Not too long ago, for some reason, I read a novel in spite of thinking it was not going to be very good, and I found some important Dharma insight there. The story was about a possible way that Stonehenge was created, how these massive stones were moved and lifted into that magnificent circle. In this story, the project began with two visionary innovators who were able to conceive of a way to do something never done before. But nothing could have been accomplished without the cooperation of several hundred volunteers who didn't understand what they were doing, had no idea how it was being done, or what the result would be. Nevertheless, they were willing to spend weeks doing extraordinarily hard physical labor. They showed up again and again in spite of violent opposition. Maybe this is how we need to be right now. In spite of not having a clear view, we hold the energy of love, of connection, that will create the path as we stay steady. We don't have to know anything specific. We just need to keep ourselves available, to be open and ready to do the work of change, to offer our energy completely to the path of love. This is our Bodhisattva vow. Questioning or scientific thinking favors humility over pride, doubt over certainty, curiosity over closure. It turns out the skills our teacher has taught us to develop are just what are needed right now. Openness, inclusiveness, resting and not knowing, our precious mantra, "Are you sure?" Brené Brown reminds us that right now we need to steer into the slide. I don't know how many of you have had the experience of driving when your vehicle starts to slide out of control. I've had this happen to me twice, and it was quite scary. Everything in you wants to jam on the brakes, grab the wheel, and turn the other way. But that can be disastrous. The instruction I'm sure we've all heard is to steer into the slide, to not fight the momentum, but to go with it and then gently direct it in a safe way. There are too many variables right now to figure out a plan. Instead, move with what is happening. Gently tap your way with your creativity into something new and introduce it as you flow with the river. Practicing to keep our hearts open, our joy alive, our connections strong. Be open to unknown possibilities. Learn to see in new ways, to rethink our assumptions about ourselves, others, and the world. Make not knowing part of our strategy. These are ways to embrace the three doors of liberation. Over the past few months, when I began the process of bringing to awareness what was most alive for me, suddenly the term spiritual warrior popped into my mind. With it came a powerful energy that made me stand up straight. No more fooling around. No time to pretend that how I spend each day doesn't matter. That there's a leeway in how I train my thoughts, words, and actions. This time is urgent. And it's a great opportunity to respond with our best. For years, I've had a document called the Warrior's Creed, which is a code of the samurai from the 14th century. Every few years, I print it out and use it as a practice. I have no idea where I got it, but it has always spoken to me as a powerful method of cutting through confusion and helping me wake up to reality. We have stepped onto the path of the Bodhisattva, which shows our willingness to leave our personal ego needs behind and to dedicate our efforts to the healing and transformation of our world. We've been exploring how to do this for the past 3 years by learning how to embody the Bodhisattvas. This code is another expression of how to travel this path. Each verse offers a glimpse of how to surrender to the path of wholeness, of how to let go of our ideas about what is needed, to make room for the great creative energy of the universe to arise. When I recently Googled this code, several links took me to a slightly different version, which I didn't like as well as this one. You can check it out for yourself if you want, and we'll make this one available to you if you want to continue practicing with it. The code has 23 short verses, and I'd like to use it now as a guided meditation, but because it's so long, I'm going to split it into two parts. So we'll start now with the first half. I'll read a verse and then we'll let it sink in for several breaths before the next one. Then I'll talk more about how the Samurai Code can help us now, and then we'll do the second set of verses. So just listen with your whole body to the 14th century Samurai Code. I have no home. I make the present moment my home. I have no power. I make the rhythm of nature my power. I have no freedom. I make awareness my freedom. I have no skills. I make ceaseless practice my skills. I have no authority. I make honesty my authority. I have no weapon. I make the absence of self my weapon. I have no rules. I make readiness and adaptability my rules. I have no enemies. I make apathy and carelessness my enemies. I have no friends. I make the earth and the sky my friends. I have no plan. I make patience my plan. I have no strategy. I make unwavering attention my strategy. I have no magic secret. I make appropriate action my magic secret. So, dear friends, can you feel how this code, this vow or prayer, this statement of authenticity reflects the essence of the three doors of liberation? Seeing beyond the need for separation, the need to create an identity, letting the path arise as we empty ourselves of anything that might hook us into a dualistic way of thinking. So samurai life was about finding a balance between strength and kindness, discipline and compassion, fighting for justice, and living with wisdom. The code of the samurai inspires us to live our lives with honor, focus, and respect for the world around us. We know that in our world of duality, every action has its polarity. We're on a seesaw. When our side is up, the other side is down, and we know we'll inevitably change places. As bodhisattvas, our aspiration is to stay at the point of balance, where all views are understood as valid but limited. Nothing is held on to, so a spaciousness can arise and hold us in possibility. Now, as often happens, not long after I received that insight to explore what it means to be a spiritual warrior, I saw an online course being offered by Pema Chodron called A Field Guide for the Dark Times, about the path of the spiritual warrior based on the teachings of Chogyam Trungpa Rinpoche. So I took the course, and briefly, here are some insights I received from that class. The essential ingredient of being a warrior is our soft spot, our open wound. Frankly, at this point, we're all the walking wounded. When we learn to step out with this awareness, we can stay unarmored and vulnerable, and our hearts can remain open. Warriors practice renunciation. We renounce anything that separates, anything that creates a barrier between self and other. We renounce anything that puts anyone out of our heart. When you stay present with fear, you find shaky tenderness and vulnerability. And in this way, you can touch the genuine heart of sadness. Tenderness is a joining emotion, connecting us, like compassion, gratitude, caring, forgiveness, longing, understanding, and regret. All these emotions help us experience our connection and teach us to stay open. If we're open, we have access to trust and to the reality of goodness. From fear to fearlessness is a process, so we practice with both discipline and gentleness using intelligent boundaries. The world we see is interdependent with our state of mind. The more we open to the world as it is, the more sacred our experience of life. We learn to put the fearful mind in the cradle of loving kindness. In this way, we train to make ourselves available. We become an island of sanity, and together we create these islands of sanity as a refuge for all. We train to live lives of decency, gentleness, and bravery. So now let's practice with the second part of our samurai code. Let's have a bell. I have no ears. I make stillness my ears. I have no eyes. I make intuition my eyes. I have no body. I make unflinching endurance my body. I have no armor. I make courage and alertness my armor. I have no fortress. I make quiet mind my fortress. I have no shield. I make reverence for life my shield. I have no sword. I make penetrating insight my sword. I have no honor. I make gentleness and compassion my honor. I have no victories. I make harmony and balance my victories. I have no rewards. I make tears and laughter my rewards. I have no life and death. I make the tides of breathing my life and death.
Take him out.
So the Buddha taught a practice called changing the peg. When a peg of wood is not the right size or is rotting or in disrepair, a carpenter will replace it by putting another peg on exactly the same spot and drive the new peg into the old one. The samurai code is a practice of changing the peg, replacing one way of thinking for another, one possession for another. We learn to replace our view that comes from our individual identity, from our ego, with the open, egoless state of one who is not separate. We learn to see with eyes of compassion, and our response naturally moves us all toward wholeness and love. So I'd like to share one more bit before we end. And I believe that most or maybe all of us here are reading and practicing with Thay Phat Hai's commentary on the sutra, The Eight Realizations of Great Beings. Recently, I was looking through a book called Awakening of the Heart, which is a compilation of 9 sutras that our teacher recommends studying. And one of these sutras is the 8 Realizations of the Great Beings. As I looked through it, I was surprised to see that at the end, there's a section called 11 Guidelines for Daily Life. I'm not sure where they came from and whether they were an original part of the sutra. I had read the sutra for many years, but had never come across these practical methods of using these teachings. So I'd like to read you the 11th guideline, because it especially spoke to me. But first, I'll tell you a story about why it did. A couple of years ago, I had a misunderstanding with a friend that led to her deciding she could no longer speak with me. I believe it was due to something a third person had told her about me that was a mistaken perception. Though I tried mightily to clear this up, nothing I said or did was received well, and it ended with my friend disassociating herself from me. It's painful to lose a friend, even though this friendship had been long but always problematic. And it's painful to believe that people misunderstand you and don't believe you when you try to correct their perception. So recently, I had just begun to wonder whether it was finally time to approach this person and gently see if she was open to speaking about the situation. Now, there's nothing wrong with doing this as long as I'm clear about my intentions and skillful in my approach. However, I don't really believe there's much chance it will be effective. So I was still evaluating whether to take any action. When I read this 11th guideline for daily life, I was reminded that what others think of me is not really my business, and certainly not under my control. And most important, that these obstacles, these difficult people, can be my greatest gifts, and I don't need to do anything to fix or change the situation. Once again, I was reminded that to be skillful, I need to let go of ego needs and seeing things from the lens of polarity. Once again, I remember that when I'm open to life as it is, rivers will flow in their natural course, and change may or may not happen in a way that I can see. So here's the guideline, the 11th guideline for daily life from the Great Beings. The Buddha spoke of sickness and suffering as effective medicines. Times of difficulties and accidents are also times of freedom and realization. Obstacles can be a form of liberation. The Buddha reminded us that the army of evil can be the guards of the Dharma. Difficulties are required for success. The person who mistreats one can be one's good friend. One's enemies are as an orchard or garden. The act of doing someone a favor can be as base as the act of casting away a pair of old shoes. The abandonment of material possessions can be wealth, and being wrongly accused can be the source of strength to work for justice. So I'd like to end with a poem and two messages from our ancestors. The poem is called Design. It's by Rosemary Watola Traumer. Imagine the self as a canyon in the making, once solid and then ongoingly made more spacious, shaped by water, by wind, by forces beyond its control. Whatever is sacred, I feel it in canyons, these earthen temples to surrender. Such holy architecture, with their deep and ancient silence, with their steep and crumbling walls. How sacred the angle of light as it enters from the rim and slants through the belly of air. Sacred too the shadows, like those most secret parts of ourselves that never see light. When I think of the self as a canyon, it is easier to believe I too can be made more spacious through surrender. The shape of my life, an ever-changing record of where I resist and where I release. Oh, this practice I am still learning to trust, this erosion of self into reverence. And two messages from our ancestors, the first one from Charles Darwin. He said, "It's not the strongest of the species that survive, nor the most intelligent, but the one most responsive to change." And then our final ancestor is Joanna Macy, the recently deceased, joyful, passionate, innovative teacher, environmental activist, and lover of life into her mid-90s. And she said, "The most remarkable feature of this historical moment on Earth is not that we are on the way to destroying the world. We've actually been on the way for quite a while. It's that we're beginning to wake up as from a millennia-long sleep to a whole new relationship to our world, to ourselves and each other." So, dear friends, there's I hear it that people like homework. So here are a few suggestions. You can work with the Samurai Code. We'll make it available. I know Tim has a copy, and Dorothy, I'll send you a copy, and maybe you can send it out and put it on the website. I like to work with it. Maybe I started working with it recently with like one verse a day. I would read one verse in the morning and just kind of be let it be with me through the day, or one verse per week, whatever you feel like doing. I also think that making the intention to notice whenever you're feeling either impatient, irritated, or constricted, and asking yourself, what am I trying to defend? And then the third thing would be continuing to work with our wonderful mantra, "Are you sure?" So we have a few announcements that I know about, and maybe there are some that I don't know about, but the ones I know about are, I think next week our sanghas are joining together again, hosted by Tiger Mountain. And I just wanted to offer a really deep bow of thanks, probably on behalf of all of us, to our Sangha leaders, to Tim and Jan and the facilitators of Tiger Mountain Sangha, And to the facilitators and the board members of Peaceful Refuge Sangha, they just do all this work in the background to make these, make everything continue to flow and be lively and continue to innovate and develop and stay steady and grounded through all of it. And then to everybody who shows up, who makes up this beloved community. So wonderful. So on December 23rd, there'll be yet another joint practice, and this one will be celebrating the winter solstice, and you'll hear more about that soon. And then we have decided that in 2026, the Sangha leaders have requested to continue our gathering and practicing together. And by the end of this year, we'll have a theme for the practice of 2026, and it'll be a similar format to the past 3 years. So those are my announcements. Does anyone have anything else?
Nancy bowing in, checking in with Tim. I have the Tiger Mountain is joining Peaceful Refuge. Do you agree with that, or are you conducting this coming week?
Nancy, we are in agreement. That's what we have on our schedule as well. So we're looking forward to joining with you again next week at 6 o'clock with your Sangha and enjoy your practice.
Thank you, everyone. And I wanted to just mention that we've both been reading the 8 Realizations of Great Being, but we're in different places in the book. And so I'm taking the liberty of taking a break and bringing to you some material from the course that I'm taking, Zen and the Art of Saving the Planet. Some insights, practice, and some contemplations from this very profound course that's been put together by Plum Village. So I hope that you'll join us and we'll all be able to enjoy together some of those very important thoughts and practices. Nancy bowing out, hope to see you. And thank you, Barbara.
And this is Tim bowing in. And thank you, Nancy, and thank you, Barbara, so much for such a powerful, timely, and appropriate teaching. For anyone that's interested, after a short break, we'll reconvene at the Tiger Mountain link, if you're interested, for some reflections and sharings and things that may have bubbled up as we listen to incorporating samurai practice into our Buddhist practice. Probably didn't see that one coming. So if you'd like to join, we'll be meeting there at our normal link in just a few minutes. Everyone's welcome.
So dear friends, we'll close out our evening with our offering the merit of our practice. May the merits of this practice benefit all beings and bring peace. Thank you, everyone. Thanks for being here.
Thank you, Barbara. Thank you.
See everyone.
Thank you.
Thank you so much, Barbara.
Yes. Thank you all.
It's been wonderful.
Dorothy, can you conclude the recording?
Yes.